Peekaboo Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the book launch for Storm, Rack, and Spindrift on Thursday, November 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. at Another Read Through in Portland. Storm, Rack, and Spindrift is a Scottish and Canadian immigrant drama, a coming-of-age story set in Nova Scotia and Scotland, dealing with political disenfranchisement, religious prejudice, and class consciousness. Again, that's the book launch for Storm, Rack, and Spindrift on Thursday, November 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. at Another Read Through, 3932 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Requiem for a Rogue, Portland debut and benefit on Saturday, November 30th from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. This is the Portland debut of Dan Kaufman's band's Modern Western Opera and a benefit to stop a fossil fuel pipeline in Oregon. Requiem for the Rogue tells the fictional story of a Southern Oregon landowner who runs afoul of a modern-day Sheriff of Nottingham, who is in cahoots with a fossil fuel pipeline company. Again, that's Requiem for the Rogue, Portland debut and benefit on Saturday, November 30th, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. You don't own the water.
You're listening to KBOO FM Portland. My name is Sophia Hellstrom-White, and this is Talking Earth. Tonight, I am joined with Andrea Gonzalez, who is a fantastic local writer of, what do you call it, short fiction?
All comedic kinds of stuff, short fiction. Plays, short fiction.
Yeah. It's so you do all kinds of stuff. So, Renaissance writer.
Or,
yeah. So, without the like creepy looking babies of the Renaissance painters.
I mean, who knows?
So, one of the reasons why Andrea has read at Talking Earth once before, and we just decided to have her back because she's about to live somewhere else and I'm about to live somewhere else. But Amanda and I will be back to host things on the regular. But so we thought, well, Andrea's still in this country, let's have her read some stuff. So, want to say hello, Andrea?
Yes. Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. Talking Earth, Sophia. Like you mentioned, I am moving across the sea to Scotland for school soon, so I'm excited to have a last creative hurrah. I've got a very interesting mix of things for tonight.
So. As you always do.
Yep. I'm ready and excited to get started.
All right, let's hear your first piece. What do you have in mind?
Yes, so this is a very short play that I wrote for a fire-themed play festival that wound up not actually taking submission, so I just had it sitting around and didn't want it to go to waste. I will definitely be doing accents throughout the night, so I am so sorry.
Oh, no, it's amazing. I've heard you do accents. I want to hear you do more accents.
All right, well, you're going to get it. Plenty of it. All right, so first of all, we have three characters that I just want to outline. We've got Rosa, who is the actress in this faux telenovela. She's Latina. She's wearing skin-tight red dress with a large rose in her hair, very stereotypical. We've got Jeremy, who is a slight and awkward actor. He has a thick fake mustache and bullfighter's clothing. And then we've got the director, who is just a general douchebag, probably wears a baseball cap. All right, we'll get started.
I cannot live without you, amor. Nor I you. Awkward kiss. Cut! Cut! There's no passion. This show isn't called Rosa Agua, amor. It's called Rosa Fuego, amor. I guess I'm just having some trouble with these lines. Yeah? What's the issue? The issue is no one talks like this. Look, we're trying to bring the telenovela genre to an American audience. They aren't expecting nuance here. They are expecting mucho drama. Yeah? It's also really hard to get into this kiss when I'm distracted by the caterpillar over my lip. Do I need this? They're not gonna know you're Latino if you don't wear the stash. I'm not Latino, though. I'm from Norfolk. Well, the stash is non-negotiable. Sorry, amigo. If we're talking costumes, I would also appreciate a looser dress so I could, you know, breathe. Sure, sweetheart. Anything else? Well, the rose seems a bit much. First of all, we get it. My name is Rosa. Secondly, I don't understand. Does this woman have a whole garden so she can pluck fresh roses for her hair every day? Where are these coming from? You're reading way too much into this. Or maybe you're not reading enough into this. Can we just please get this take done? Seriously, this thing itches and then leaves a huge rash. It's very unpleasant. Yeah, yeah. Vamonos. I cannot live without you, amor. Nor I you. Kiss. But there is something I have to tell you. What is it, mi cariño? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Cut. Did you change that line? It's supposed to be mi amor. Yeah, but I said amor like 2 seconds ago. You don't find that a bit redundant? The Bachelor spillover audience is not going to know what carino means. It's cariño, and it's an affectionate term. Yeah, well, it sounds to me like an Italian food chain, so don't use it again. Can I drop the accent? What? Why? Because I feel like it sounds a little fake. Because it is fake. Where does this show even take place? Excuse me? Are we in America? No, you're in Latin America. Technically, that's the same thing. If we are in a Latin-speaking country, we should just speak Spanish or whatever dialect they speak in that place. It doesn't make sense that we would speak English with a Spanish accent. Gorgeous, gorgeous, stupid girl. I'm not going to ask the hard-working American to come home after a long day of work to read their television. Now, can we get back to the scene? God, fine. What is it, mi amor?
I have wronged you.
How?
I had a night of passion with your twin sister, Maria Elena Lorena Luis.
Oh, you scoundrel! How dare you betray me? Awkward slap.
Nope, that was terrible. You have to slap him like you mean it.
I don't want to hurt him.
You don't actually have to slap him. I'm not sure if you were aware, but acting, it's pretend. We just gotta make it look real. It's gonna look idiotic if I fake it. Fine then. Hit him. I don't care. As long as it looks good.
I would prefer if she did not actually hit me. I have a fragile constitution.
It's true, he was once knocked over by a large butterfly.
I'm pretty sure it was a colorful moth, but...
Well, sounds like now's the time to man up, hermano. Let's take it from how dare you.
How dare you betray me?
Realistic slap.
Shite! Puta! I mean, mierda! Can I say that?
No.
Sorry, Jeremy.
The slap was great, though. We can cut the swearing. Keep going.
You can hurt me here, amor. Motions to cheek. But you can never hurt me here.
Motions dramatically to heart.
This will always belong to you.
Grabs Rosa's hand and puts it on his chest as he pulls her in.
Oh, Jose, your words burn through me.
Mi amor, don't you know? We are the fuego.
Awkward kiss. Are you kidding me? Do you kiss your girlfriend like that?
I don't actually have a girlfriend, so... Yeah, clearly. Hey, leave him alone. When you make love to a woman, you kiss her like this.
Director forcibly grabs Rosa and tries to plant one on her. She shoves him off. Jeremy gets in his face and slaps him.
Oh, not okay!
Wow, that was kind of hot.
You're kind of hot.
You want to say that to my face? Jeremy gets close to Rosa.
You are very attractive to me and you smell like fresh pears.
Rosa dips Jeremy and kisses him for real.
See, that's what I was looking for. Well, too bad, because your stupid, racist show is officially dead,
throws flower at director.
Comprende?
See.
Right. Was that it?
That was it for that one.
Oh, I was trying so hard not to laugh into the mic, so I was over here like, oh, wow.
I appreciate it. I know I'm landing it if Sophia is like trying to hold back the laughter. I appreciate that.
Oh, you are landing it. So I assume there's going to be more awkwardness of me bent over like that throughout the night.
I sure hope so.
Give us more, please.
All right. Well, the next one is going to be a little bit more serious, just a bit. This is a really short story that I wrote one day. I'm a very anxious person, as many are, and I feel like this kind of came from that. So this is a short story called Embrace the Rain. I woke up to the pitter-patter of incessant rainfall. Another gray Saturday morning here to ruin my mood. The smell of dirt and must wafted off my window pane. I got out of bed and checked my cabinets, but remembered that I had eaten the dregs of my Fruit Loops the previous night as an alternative to a pint of iced cookie dough ice cream, which is what I really wanted. There was a bagel shop a couple of blocks away. It wouldn't be hard to throw on some clothes and make my way over there, but I was still adjusting to the ghostly chill of the air in my studio and dreaded having to walk in this wet vest. But I had no other option. I put on my slate gray raincoat. It had a gaping hole in the left pocket from the jaws of the scrappy corgi that lived in the apartment next door. It's always the cute ones that hurt you the worst. I wanted to put on my waterproof boots, but I had wandered into a pile of dog shit, or even potentially human shit, a few days past and had trouble scraping it all off with a plastic spoon. There were so many deep grooves and I could only handle the smell for so long. When I opened my shoe closet, I could still detect the tainted scent of it. I went for my scuffed up brown leather boots, hoping the puddles wouldn't be as deep as they had been during the last bout of rain. I zipped up my coat and looked in the mirror. I hated how the raincoat made me look shorter than I already was. It was too long to be short and too short to be long. I walked outside and realized the rain was coming down even harder than I had anticipated. I put my hood up. I was wearing jeans and I thought about how it would take a while for them to dry once I got back home and how impossible it'd be to fully relax in damp pants. It was also so much colder than I thought it'd be. I wish I had a coat that was thicker than a raincoat, but still impervious to the wet and wind. Or maybe I should have grabbed a scarf. I definitely should have put on my knit beanie instead of wrestling my bedhead into a messy topknot. I caught a glimpse of my reflection in a store window. With the hood over my bun, I looked like a conehead. While I was focused on my distorted image, I stepped right into a massive puddle. There must have been an unassuming gap between my boot and the sole of my right shoe because immediately I could sense the water rushing in. I cringed at every squish, squish I felt when I took another step. I'd definitely have to change socks when I got home, but I wasn't sure I had any clean ones left. And that is when I saw him. An older gentleman, probably in his late 60s, wearing nothing but a pine green University of Oregon sweatshirt, sporting massive holes, a pair of ill-fitting, light-wash jeans, and white sneakers, every crevice etched with dirt. He had his hands in his pant pockets and was walking across the same intersection as I was, but he seemed so strangely serene. There was no trace of discomfort in his face. He looked straight ahead with a hint of a smile. He didn't hesitate when he stepped in the same puddle I had, but he kept walking, no, marching, without an ounce of concern. He was practically Jesus, walking on water, and I was Peter, a gaping-mouthed, gobsmacked witness of a miracle. I thought, honestly, how was he not freezing? Did he not realize how disgusting the weather was? How could he be so content on a shit morning like this? Where was this guy headed that he could look so rough but so okay with it? Was he fully right in the head? I couldn't stop thinking about the man with an almost aggressive annoyance. Did he not feel it like I did? Every detail, every minute worry dropping on me with a ping, ping, ping. And everyone stung like being pelted by the pellets of a BB gun. I wondered if I'd ever be like him. So nonchalant, so unfazed. I wondered if I'd ever be able to embrace the rain.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, well, I'll guess just, if you need, like, to take a drink of water.
I'll take a sip of water.
Dramatic sip of water sounds.
There's a lot of dramatic sipping.
Dramatic sipping.
So this one was the first chapter to a novel that I was considering and still am still considering writing at some point, called Husband Hunting, that came out of my disaster of a romantic life. But also, you know, it's funny, I used to have a really great creative writing teacher for almost all of high school, and I would try and write like fantasy and like other cool stuff, and he would just be really honest with me and say, Andrea, you're really good at writing sassy females. Just do that. So I feel like that voice definitely comes out in this one. And I think it's just fun and relatable. So here's the first chapter of Husband Hunting. Growing up, you always hear that the most important thing is to try. I'm 31, verging on 32, and still single, and I think maybe I'm not trying hard enough. And how does a millennial try harder at dating? They pick up their phones and start swiping like it's their job. Bumble is for strong, independent women. Sometimes that's me, and sometimes I want a guy to be so incredibly moved by my doughy brown eyes and my razor-sharp jawbones in this immaculately lit selfie that he's moved to start the conversation. Tinder has the entire male single population of Portland. That means you've got to rifle through way more pictures of guys with face tattoos and pet ferrets. Hinge is decent, better prospects, but 94.3% of the guys are toting a rifle or a dead fish. Is that the worst thing in the world? No. Are these uber masculine activities compensating for something, aka the reason they are on a dating app? Probably. Am I being irrational? Yes. Coffee meets bagel helps with the addictive nature of the swiping, since you only get 1 to 4 guys a day. It makes the app situation less of a game and more of a real-life decision. But you will also only go on one date every 6 months, and usually he's boring, and no wonder he was on Coffee Meets Bagel. At a certain point, the apps are more work than they're worth, so you give up on them and start attending art shows and concerts with local artists, hoping that doing the things you love will lead to finding someone you love. I saw that once in a rom-com and thought it was incredibly sage advice. But then you don't meet anyone, or you do, and he's a sexy bassist, but he's married to the world's hottest woman, so fuck her. And then you're back to square one, wondering if you're trying hard enough, and the phone comes back out. And I would like to believe that I am not the most pathetic woman in the world. I have plenty of days when I feel like I can live an explorative and full life all on my own. I think, hey,
Maybe I'll go to Paris next month. Oh, wait, I can't afford that. Maybe Seattle then. I couldn't be so bold with my last-minute travel plans if I had a husband and 2.5 kids. And since I don't have to cook for people and ensure their survival, that means I can order greasy takeout every damn day. Nothing tastes better than food that was made by someone else. I want to feel energized in my career, too, but sadly, building websites for Dennis doesn't quite fulfill me. But I do have my side projects. Writing plays, novels, pilot episodes of procedural dramas. Agent Ellie finds the perpetrator has a fetish for flushing strangers' toilets, causing floods all over the quiet North Carolina suburb. But most days, I feel like all of my deep-seated fantasies of love and romance and a dedicated partnership are impossible. And without a partner, life, even one with endless travel and the joys of a full stomach, loses its luster. Growing up, I was the kind of girl who would only be able to fall asleep by imagining grand romances with tortured artists in Spain, rugged farmhands in Texas, and skater boys in SoCal. The desire that a man will love me unconditionally and want me until the day I die has become so deeply ingrained in my psyche that I now believe it to be a part of my physiology. And you might be thinking, obviously, physical attraction is the reason we procreate, you dumb bitch. But it's more than just a simple physical attraction. When I flirt with a man, I give him a little pat in the chest with the back of my hand, and I feel tiny firecrackers explode up my chest and travel up to my brain, which is already trying to decide if I should take his last name when we get married. I am already letting the little lovesick gnomes in the back of my head start yelling at each other. Sound the alarm! This could be the one! The electricity becomes undeniable, the fire irresistible. And then he says some dumb shit about how he didn't get into Yale because of affirmative action, and the sizzle dissipates into thin air with a disappointed sigh. Only 4 short months ago, I thought I was finally done. I thought I had found the man who would settle on living with me for the rest of his life. Kevin O'Donnell, a good name for a kind and lanky Irishman. I finally allowed myself to scope out the stunning wedding dresses in the Anthropology windows outside my office. I would look amazing in that. My boobs are way too big for that one. Are capes a wedding thing now? God, I hope so. We had only been dating for 7 months, but that was 3 months longer than any of my relationships post-high school. If you aren't sick of each other after 4 months, I thought that meant you could handle being together forever. Then, it all came crashing down with one swing of the wrecking ball. You see, Kevin had always had this close friend from college named Alexa. I always had a bad feeling about her. This is not because I am an unevolved anti-feminist who doesn't believe men and women can be friends, but when your man's friend is a 5'6", thin but fit, nose-ringed, cool-without-trying chick with over 5,000 Instagram followers, I believe concern is warranted. It was raining when she showed up at my door. I hadn't put on any makeup that day and was already wearing a 7-year-old pilly flannel shirt and soccer sweatpants. When I heard the aggressive knocking, I was halfway through a pint of half-baked. First, I tried ignoring it. I paused Criminal Minds and didn't move a muscle. Hardly took a breath, as I was a firm believer in Jurassic Park logic. They can't see you if you don't move. But this fucker wouldn't go away, and then my phone started ringing relentlessly. I wondered why Kevin was calling me. We hardly ever called each other. I mean, God, what was this, 1987? What is urgent enough that couldn't be sent via text? I figured it was him at the door, so I ignored the phone. I grabbed my mustard yellow beanie to cover the grease nest that was my messy lob. I flung the door open, and there was Alexa, dripping wet, but somehow still looking like she had just stepped off the set of America's Next Top Model. Under her green zip-up, she had a black belly shirt on.
exposing 2 inches of her chiseled figure. I felt the weight of the ice cream grow heavy in the innards of my pooch. "We need to talk," she said. "Why?" I asked. "Kevin and I are in love, and he's too much of a wimp to end things with you, so I'm doing it myself." "Are you high?" "What? No." "Shit." I threw the door back in her face. My heart was pounding out of my chest, and I had enough adrenaline to hulk out and toss a school bus. But instead, I fell to the ground and tried to hold back the urge to vomit all over my welcome mat. It was the most humiliated I had ever felt. A couple of hours later came part 2. Kevin wouldn't leave until I acknowledged him. "What do you want?" I asked through the door. I couldn't get myself to open it. The only thing I wanted in the world was for him to hold me and tell me it was all a lie. But I knew that wasn't going to happen. So I kept the barrier between us clasped shut. He wouldn't have the victory of seeing my face, red and huge like a pufferfish. "Will, I'm so sorry. I didn't want it to go like this. I was trying to figure out how to tell you." The blood was running hot through my veins. I thought I'd cough up Tabasco when I opened my mouth. "Hold on. What were you going to say that was going to make, 'Hey, babe, I cheated on you,' sound any better? I'm really curious, Kevin. I am dying to know." "I don't know, Wilson. I didn't want it to be so dramatic. Okay, Alexa shouldn't have come here. I asked her specifically not to do that." "Well, since you asked her specifically, I guess it's fine. Can you open the door?" "Absolutely not. You are not welcome in this house. It's an apartment. You know what I mean." "Okay, I'm sorry. I'll go. But if you want to talk, I'm here." "Nah, think I'm good. And Kevin, thank you, really, for the mediocre relationship." I slid to the ground and laid in a pool of my own salty tears for 3 hours straight. After Kevin came the usual breakup routine. I had honed it over the last 7 years. I'd take about 3 to 5 days off from work, claiming I had contracted the bird flu. I would spend hours upon hours watching food television while also consuming meals I spent way too much money for on Postmates. I stopped cleaning my dishes, stopped shaving, stopped taking out the trash. I basically became a disgusting Lady Jabba for about 2 weeks. If it weren't for Jen, I probably would have been absorbed by my mattress. Jen and I had known each other since college. Even though she was Asian and I was Hispanic, we were both confused for each other all the time. A lot of people assumed it was because we were both short and racially ambiguous. But I think it was more than that. We were both a little alternative for the Deep South college we attended. We both existed together on the outer fringes of Alabama hipster culture, whatever that is. And as such, we both stuck together like weirdos in a very exclusive cult. She knew me well enough to know I needed to be alone on week 1 of the breakup cycle. But week 2, she would visit with soup and vegan versions of the garbage I love to put in my body. When she wasn't there, she'd follow up with texts. "Eat vegetables." "But carbs." "Put the vegetables between some carbs. It's called a sandwich." Fine. But the best part of having Jen around was that she had finally helped me get rid of my nasty texting habit. In my earlier 20s, when I'd get dumped, I would send the cringiest texts imaginable. "You were wrong? We were made for each other? You will never meet anyone as well-read and with as much knowledge of the Portland restaurant scene as me. Dot, dot, dot. I will light your shit on fire. And so on and so forth. It was because I had this rage in me, a wild animal shaking the bars of its cage, and it felt like the only way to calm it down was to press the send button on those lengthy, emotional texts. I felt like I needed to be heard or I'd die. It wasn't until I realized I was already being heard that I was able to stop. Jen would confiscate my phone and listen to me rant for hours. God bless that woman and her patience. She was already married to her college sweetheart, but she still knew what it was like to have her heart broken. It took me several months to fully recover from the Kevin catastrophe, but finally I felt like I was ready to shop around, maybe find something that mattered. But once again, I had no idea where to start, so I whipped out the phone. But this time, something was different. I swiped right on a photo of a cute guy named David with ashy brown hair and a ginger beard. He had horn-rimmed glasses, and his interests included the extended version of The Lord of the Rings and Kristen Wiig in all her forms. He had a cute tagline about being rated 5 stars among grandmas everywhere. When we matched, my heart did a backflip, and I immediately sent him my generic, "Hey, David, how's your week been?" text. He responded within minutes, and we were discussing the best adornments for a high-class mac and cheese. That night, I went to bed thinking about all of the couples I knew that had met via Tinder. Beth is getting married to her Tinder beau. Cheryl just moved in with hers. Carolyn's been dating hers for almost a year now. This could work. We met at a coffee shop the following Saturday morning at 10 a.m., I was hesitant at the suggestion. I hate coffee dates. I prefer to drink alcohol, which lessens the nerves, not coffee, which makes you shaky and amplifies your awkward and gives you the shits. But alas, I took my chances because I really thought I would like this guy. When he saw me, he stood up and shook my hand. I know that shouldn't seem strange, but it was. Even stranger was that before he took a sip of his already half-empty mug of coffee, he took out a tiny hand sanitizer and he used it. Did my hand gross him out that much? He didn't have to shake it in the first place. I ordered my drink and returned. "How was your Friday?" I asked, thinking it was a safe way to start the conversation. "It was rough, actually," he responded. I was not expecting that. "Oh, I'm sorry. Why was it rough?" "My cat passed away."
Oh, wow, that is terrible. I'm so sorry. How long did you have him?"
"I did not want to know."
"Well, I should clarify, it wasn't my cat, it was my friend's cat, but I accidentally let him out and he ran into the street." "Oh, that is so upsetting." I started to brainstorm how I could gracefully exit this conversation. "I think I lost my best friend over it. Anyways, how was your weekend?"
It was good. Not eventful. Just watched some SNL and some YouTube videos."
"YouTube videos of what?"
"Cats." DIY, mostly."
"Oh, you DIY?"
"No." I took a large gulp of coffee. I was already trembling.
"Sorry, I probably weirded you out with all that cat stuff. I didn't mean to. You just asked what happened, and I didn't want to make stuff up, you know. I like to be honest."
Yeah. No, it's fine. I get it."
I did not get it.
We continued to make conversation for an hour before I was able to escape. The rest of the hour was in whatever. The remaining conversation was less cringy, and we had a few things in common, but afterwards I felt nothing.
The same had always happened after every first app date I'd ever been on. It was the reason I had never had a second app date. I felt absolutely nothing. The only time I ever actually dated someone from Tinder or the rest of the gambit of apps was because I ran into them later on in real life. That's how it was with Kevin. We had talked on Bumble, but then I lost interest. A few weeks later, I ran into him at a local showing of The Room. We bonded over our shared affection for Tommy Wiseau's unidentifiable accent and his use of multiple oddly arranged studded belts. I guess at that point we had a story. A story. It hit me like a soccer ball to the gut. That night, I pounded on Jen's door until she opened up. I have an idea. What? I feel like every guy I've ever liked has had some sort of history with me. What do you mean? Like, Ben worked with me. We had the office romance thing going on. Same for John. Lenny was from my theater troupe. We had to kiss on stage, which led to kissing off stage, and you know the rest. Kevin was the could-have-been Tinder fling that became the actual thing. Okay, where is this going? I need to go back and find all the guys, the could-have-beens, the ones with the stories, and see if any stick. Sorry, I still don't understand what you're saying. How many espressos have you had today? 3? But that's not important. I'm going to travel for a while. I'm going to reconnect with old flames or not flames that could have been flames. And maybe, just maybe, I'll make something happen. That sounds insane. But, Jen, you don't understand. I have to try. Sane.
Yeah, we're both going to clap. Andrea, that was too familiar.
I know. It's not totally me, but like 70% me.
Yeah.
The next one's going to require a lot of accents.
I am excited.
Yeah. Here we go. I apologize to anybody from the UK who's listening to the next one, because it's just a slew of like Irish and British accents.
They need to hear this as like penance for like all the American accents. That's on Doctor Who.
Yes. Okay. We're on the same page. So this one requires a little bit more context. So this is the second act in a full-length play that I'm still working on, called Walking Shadows. And it is about 5 generations of a family that see the same group of ghosts. So they're haunted by these ghosts. Other people can't see them, just the people in this bloodline. And what I was really trying to do with this is to kind of explore what it's like to have this haunting, this, you know, it's very much a metaphor for mental illness, to go from generation to generation, and how, you know, we can learn to strengthen ourselves and grow throughout those experiences and through the years and through the countries. I wanted this to feel like, you know, the typical story from someone who, for example, myself, my parents are from Nicaragua, Cuba, just a couple of generations before them came from Spain. So with this story, I started out in Act One with a young girl and her father in Scotland, inspired by the fact that I'm going there. So I was thinking about it a lot. This father basically uses his daughter to make money because she can see these ghosts, she can affect these ghosts. And so he uses her during this spiritualist movement of the 1890s to get them better off. And then the second act takes us to the daughter of that little girl who is living in 1920s London now. The little girl, you know, succeeds, grows up, becomes popular, moves to London. And so now we're seeing her daughter and how her daughter is kind of dealing with these ghosts and with
with this sort of affliction, I guess we could call it. And then from there, you know, we would take a look at her son, and it goes on and on. So this one, I just took the second act that's focused on this young woman living in 1920s London, who's also kind of embraced this spiritualist movement, using her abilities to make her popular in the culture. So the characters are Dory, who is the woman in question, James, who is the love interest, Mrs. Dorkin, who comes in towards the beginning of the scene, she's an older woman, and a doctor, who we're just going to say is male. He could, you know, could be a woman. Probably not. It's 1920s London, sad to say. Ghosts. We've got some ghosts here. We have B-Man, who is a man quite literally covered in bees. We've got the nun, who is a young woman. She's constantly praying. We have a little boy. That's pretty self-explanatory. And we have Silent Man, who is a stoic man with his lips stitched shut. Lights up on a cluttered flat. There is a table at the center with Dory at the head. Mrs. Dorkin is to her right and James is to her left. Welcome, dearest friends, to my home. My story begins with a little girl and her horrid father. My mother had a special talent for seeing spirits. After the mysterious and violent death of her father, she came to London and became known as the Red Cap, after a goblin who preferred isolation to friendships, one who dipped his cap in the blood of those he destroyed, one who could understand those buried deep in the dirt better than he could understand the living. Will we be able to see the things, the spirits or ghosts or whatnot? Not in the way you'd expect. Spirits don't take up space like you and I. They are everywhere and everything at all times. Occasionally, like a spark, you might get a glimpse of them, but it'll just be a piece like an echo. But it passes quickly. At least, it will for all of you. And for you. They are always with me. Hovering, baiting, judging, whispering. That's unfortunate. Yes, well, tonight is not about me, but all of you. Maybe you've lost someone close to you. Maybe you are yearning to find answers. Or maybe you are simply suffering from the lack of the individual, their presence, the comfort of their existence.
Yeah, just get on with it then.
Everyone? Close your eyes and take the hands of those next to you. Find the place in the pit of your stomach where the pain weighs heaviest.
Don't recall that being a part of a human's anatomy.
Quiet, please. I need quiet. Silent Man appears behind Dory. She is aware. Nun appears as well, praying. Mrs. Dorkin. That's your name, is it not?
Yes, well, that's not much of a surprise, is it? I bought a bloody voucher.
And you recently lost your husband?
Yes. I'd imagine you get many widows through your doors.
You'd be correct.
He was a quiet man, wasn't he?
Exceptionally withdrawn towards the end?
Yeah. He'd always been a little squeak of a man.
And the stutter. You hoped it would improve, but it never did.
Of course.
He did love you, if that's what you were wondering.
Of course he did. He was my husband.
But you didn't love him, did you?
Excuse me? How dare you?
You're afraid, I understand.
You understand nothing, you impertinent little louse. You weren't the reason he did it.
What? You weren't the only reason he did it. Go on. He was beyond help, Mrs. Dorkin. To him, the golden leaves of fall seemed frail and withered, the smell of fresh blooms nauseating and intolerable. He lost the ability to smile genuinely because to him, everything, including you, became dust packed into different shapes. I'm sorry. There was no saving him from the ultimate despair. You. Wretched, wretched girl. I know sometimes these truths can be jarring. You steal the pence from our pockets and make us decent men and women look like fools. There's no cause to be upset, ma'am. I paid. I got the right to say and do whatever I please. You're a liar and a thief. Oh, is that so? Mrs. Dorkin flinches. Ow! Someone's pricked to me. And who could that be? Stop. I said stop right this minute. You can see me clear as day, ma'am. I'm not doing a thing. How are you doing this? Oh, God. There's blood. I'm bleeding. I tell you what's happening, but considering I'm a liar and a thief, I don't think you'd believe me. Witch. You're a witch. You're going to go straight to hell. I hear it's significantly warmer there than London this time of year, so sounds quite fine to me.
Dory can't resist curling her lips into a smile.
All right, ma'am. I think it's time for you to go.
Scene changes to Dory taking off her stage ensemble and getting ready to leave. Enter James.
You, again? Yes, 'tis I, again.
You know, I find you quite irritating.
Irritating?
How so, Dory?
First of all, because you deign to call me by my first name, which is a right reserved strictly for my mother and for my butcher.
You're that close with your butcher. I'm not convinced mine even speaks English. I say something, he grunts, wipes the pig's blood off his.
Secondly, you're robbing a seat from a brand new audience member who could spread the word of my talents to China, the Americas, the corners of Arabia.
Oh, plans to take over the world then.
And why not?
If anyone could do it, it'd be you.
See?
That's my third problem.
What troubles me the most about your constant occupancy in my audience is that I know you are here to admire me and not my work.
You don't find it flattering to have a suitor?
You are not a suitor. That would imply there was a possibility that your affections could be reciprocated.
You don't even know me.
Nor you me. If you did, you'd keep a safe distance. Safety is for cowards and boors. Don't come back here. I do not want you in my audience again.
Okay.
Okay. That's it. I am persistent, but I am still a gentleman. And of course I wouldn't dare stand in the way of your global ambitions.
James makes to leave. But when you realize you miss having me around, you can find me at the pub. The Mayflower, to be specific. Any night, every night, I'll wait. Good night, Miss Watson.
Good night, little dream drifter.
James looks confused, smiles slyly.
My mom used to call me that.
How do you know that?
I knew Mrs. Williams' husband stuffed ferrets for leisure and Mr. DuPont's son preferred twinnings to Tetley. I know a lot of things.
Brilliant. So you already know my name, don't you?
Of course I do, James.
Exit James. B man appears, frightening Dory. He is in agony.
Oh, you can be quite a lot, did you know that?
The pain is constant?
Yes, well, nothing I can do to help you.
What? What did I do?
I'm not having this conversation with you again.
She starts swatting at invisible bees around her. They're not real. They're not real. Dory tries to compose herself, but Bee Man is still screaming in pain.
Stop! Stop it! Quiet! Quiet!
What did I do to deserve this?
Well, my friend, you walked into a hive of bees.
Dory exits stage left. Set changes to Dory's bedroom. She stumbles in, slightly inebriated, with James behind her.
You know, I wondered if you'd take the bait.
Don't flatter yourself too much. I got bored.
And you thought I'd be what? Entertaining?
There's something about your face.
If you're trying to call me handsome,
your face is perfectly crooked.
Thank you.
I like it. Every time I look at you, it's new. It changes with every angle and expression. You don't see a lot of faces like that.
Well, I find your visage quite stunning as well, though not for its crookedness, but for the notable flames burning behind the...
Dory grabs James by the collar and kisses him.
Well, we're just jumping right in then, aren't we?
Why not? Seeing as we're all going to die, might as well get what we can while we're here.
They continue making love, removing some items of clothing. James is unsure, Dory is not.
Wait!
What?
Are you familiar with the Viennese waltz?
Yes.
However, I'm not seeing the relevance of the subject at this particular moment.
James stands, offers his hand to Dory.
I want to get to know you.
Why?
Because I like you. I'm amazed by you, quite honestly.
That's flattering, but James, what's it all about in the end?
It's about love.
It's about sex.
You really think that?
Based on my experience, yes.
Maybe you've had some subpar experiences.
Not all were subpar.
God, how many have there been? Sorry, never mind. It's none of my business. I don't care.
Yes, you do.
I don't.
Dance with me.
I don't want to dance.
You don't want to, or you're afraid to.
I look ridiculous.
Well, we'll be ridiculous together.
Oh, define one, and then you let it rest.
The pair dance. It's awkward at first. Dory is avoiding eye contact. But then she looks at him. Nun sings a beautiful, soft hymn in the background. The music builds along with the joy. The two kiss, but gently, lovingly.
That wasn't so bad, was it?
Not terrible.
Bee-Man appears behind James and Dory flinches, thinking there are bees around her.
Are you all right?
Yes. Yes, I just think there's a chill in the air.
Dory flinches again.
Is there a window somewhere? A hole in the wall?
James starts looking around, hoping to solve the problem.
I think you should leave.
Now?
Yes, I think you should leave right now.
You are very hard to predict, you know that? Just moments ago, you were prepared for me to spend the night, and now you wouldn't have lasted the night.
Okay, I'll leave, but I think it'd be a mistake.
Maybe the biggest one you'll ever make.
Don't give yourself so much credit.
All right, then.
James puts on his coat, hat, and makes to leave.
Wait!
I'm sorry I am. Come back tomorrow during the day? James smiles, nods, and exits. Dory turns her attention to B-Man.
Go away!
James re-enters. He has a mustache to symbolize that time has passed. Dory pursues him.
You shouldn't have done that. You get so carried away. He was harassing me. Am I supposed to sit there and allow myself to be berated by some weasel of a man who can hardly tie his left shoe? You should have let me handle the situation.
And what would you have done? Give him a firm talking to?
Ah, well, I wouldn't have slung a lit candle at him.
I didn't hit him.
Thank Christ. But even so, if Manderly hadn't stopped it out, there would have been some serious consequences. Life or death consequences. There's no need to overreact. I'm sorry. There's no need to overreact. I'm sorry. You're telling me not to overreact. The woman who almost burned down an entire flat because a man called her washed up. And overweight. And an embarrassment. You shouldn't listen, Dory. What they think, it doesn't matter in the end. It matters to my success. My reputation is pertinent to my career, to our livelihood. Huh? Well, then you should do a better job of maintaining it. I know, you're right. I was just so angry and my head is in a constant fog. Should I call the doctor again? No, I've already seen him. And what did he prescribe? Oh, you know, sunshine, apples, plenty of rest. It's going to be a long 9 months.
James looks at Dory, confused and a bit frightened.
Are you pregnant?
Dory nods.
But we're not married.
But we are fornicating.
I need a minute.
Are you not happy?
No, I am happy. Of course I am. It's a wonderful thing.
James goes to Dory, holds her and kisses her forehead.
Should I stay with you tonight?
Why wouldn't you?
I just... With the news, I wasn't sure if you'd want some extra space, some time on your own.
I don't.
Good. Good, let's get to bed then.
They both undress to their undergarments and get under the covers. James goes to shut his eyes and Dory stays propped up in a sitting position.
Are you going to do this again?
It takes me longer to fall asleep than you. But I don't understand why you don't read a book or do some journaling or anything.
I don't need those things.
You could try. It might help, honestly.
They're distractions.
Distractions from what?
I need to think.
Maybe if you got more rest, like the doctor prescribed, you'd be less finicky and temperamental.
I'm protecting us.
From what?
From everything.
I don't want to argue with you, Dory. You're with child now and you should try a bit harder to get some rest. But if you don't want to, that's your decision.
Fine. I'll try.
Dory lays down and tries to sleep, facing James. B-Man appears, wailing.
Why? Why was I such a fool? I shouldn't have trusted him. Danny, why did you do this to me?
Dory tosses to the other side, curls up, covers her ears. She doesn't notice that James sees her. He closes his eyes and pretends to sleep. Dory sits back up again and watches B-Man. Lights dim and come back up. Dory's stomach has grown to show the passage of time. And I'll end it there. End it a little early because we're running out of time. Portland. Oh, Portland, you are a city of grime covered in a thin layer of piss. You reek of marijuana. My parents hate you. They say you are pretty with your snow-capped mountain peaks and blue-hued outlines of pines towering on high hills in the distance, but too bad about all those homeless and naked liberals blocking traffic on their bikes. Oh, Portland, you love to riot like it's 1792. You love being on the cusp of disaster. You love shattering windows of subways for no good reason other than to break the metaphorical barriers to who knows what. You love being just daring enough. So much so, I walk softly on the balls of my feet from one end of my carpeted room to the other to not upset the tectonic plates that could shift at any moment and cause my home to crumble on my fragile skull. But nothing too terrible ever happens. Many times, Portland, I thought you would end me. You despised me. You would swallow me. And then nothing. Except I kept walking past pastel craftsmen exploding with wildflowers that look like alien life forms, soft golden funnels sprouting 4 feet tall, ornamented with baby blue baubles and long green leaves taller than me. I walk straight into the coffee shop I go to every day, wide white walls slashed with pops of paint, clean, sharp, alive. I take a sip of pure life, pure joy. Oh, Portland, you are some kind of magic.
And that was Andrea Gonzalez, and this was Talking Earth. Have a good night.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale.
This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio.
Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. till 7 p.m.
We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Saturday, December 14th. The sale will be held on December 21st. Stay tuned for details.
Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasure to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for our community radio station.